In fact, she rushed in where angels feared to tread. There might have been deficiencies in her ability, but that is also doubtful. Nevertheless, the reiteration of these simple phrases went on to the point where she was reduced to a condition of near hysteria. Something inside warned her to pretend to collapse, and she did this while attempting to maintain an inner barrier against the suggestions. She pretended to give way and collapse, and when she did, the directoress purred over her like a happy, contented cat and let her go. She went back to her room and then really did collapse on her bed. The window had been left open, the weather was cold and it had commenced to snow and freeze. With snow blowing in on her as she lay on top of the bed with no covering, she slept in this semi-conscious state for 30 hours. Another student of the institution got in contact with Violet's parents, who came to fetch her from the school. Although they were exceedingly suspicious, nothing could be proved. As far as Violet Firth was concerned, the entire episode in the office had ceased to exist. She had completely repressed it. Her parents took her home, a nervous wreck. The family doctor unfortunately gave her something like bromide as a sedative, and this made matters worse. He did, however, give us his opinion that she had been hypnotized. Only when she realized that this was a possibility and began to face up to the consequences did she get some degree of relief. She could not do any form of work, her mind raced, and she was afraid that if she gave it its head there would be some sort of complete mental disintegration. She used to spend hours doing simple sums in an exercise book to try and give her mind something to bite on. This condition gradually abated, but she was left in a depleted condition, subject to extreme nervous prostration when put under any stress whatsoever. However, she did at least nominally recover to the point where she could take up some sort of employment. Violet Firth, or Dion Fortune, was not very well educated. She had done no foreign travel and had little experience, though she had worked during World War I in the capacity of a lay Freudian analyst. Having seen some of the results of the war, she never wanted to travel. Consequently, she was somewhat narrow in her outlook. She always suspected scholarship when it appeared heavy, as she thought there must be something very illuminating in its depths that she could not understand. Because of this feeling, she very carefully avoided subjects that she did not feel qualified to talk about. She was also terribly snobbish, which was a trait her parents had developed in her by not letting her play with other girls of lower class, and who probably in those days would have been very painfully aware of their own position. Dion Fortune was not close to anyone. She seemed only to mix with people in the mysteries and had few friends outside of the occult world to which she gave all her energies. She had no significant connection with the Orthodox Church, but she had been raised nominally in the Church of England. This was a time of great interest in New Thought, and the tendency was to replace established religion with New Thought affirmations and things of that sort. Violet's mother had joined the Christian Science Church, so it was very easy for Violet, a pragmatic young woman, full of New Thought, New Psychology, and New Liberation for Women, to ignore religious matters until she was brought face to face with the extremely painful revelation of her lack of development on the devotional nature. This came about through a rather profound experience in a dream, from which she realized that the significance of much of the Christian message applied to her. At this same time, she began to develop a deeper interest in the Theosophical Society. The attraction here was probably triggered by her own unfortunate experience at the commercial school. Until that time, she had not realized that there were things going on, which could not be explained by normal, physical means. She had also come into contact with other people who associated with a group called the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and this piqued her interest in the mystical occult even further. Next headline is, Mystical Experience. One night, Dion Fortune had a dream where she saw herself reading in the library of the Theosophical Society headquarters in London. As she raised her eyes from her book, a section of the wall solid with books and shelves faded away, revealing a stairway out into space. Some inner force made her rise and start climbing this stairway. The building apparently disappeared after a while, and she was walking up the stairway through space with only emptiness on either side of it. She continued, and finally came out on a plateau where three great figures were standing. These entities were a blend of columns of pulsating and moving force represented as colored lights and shaped into a semblance of humanoid form. Their confidence and bearing radiated a feeling of extraordinary power and love. They could communicate at the human level but were obviously superhuman beings. Dion Fortune was compelled to move toward them and of her own volition knelt before them. She understood by the colors of the light that made up their robes that one represented the elemental contacts and the forces of nature, another was devotional and represented the inner powers behind the Christian Church, the Master Jesus in the occult sense, while the third figure also bathed in color was essentially hermetic, representing what we know as the Western mysteries. Dion Fortune was made to understand that her natural path was probably hermetic but she also would require the forces of nature and devotion to do the work she was to do in this lifetime. These three great entities pointed out that she was severely and dangerously deficient in the spiritual qualities exemplified by the Master Jesus. If she elected, she should follow the devotional path of inner development for a time. This undertaking would be painful and difficult and result in little outward progress, but it would balance out her inner nature and in some way make her a more acceptable leader for the future. She accepted this challenge and was filled with an enormous amount of emotion which was quite foreign to her ordinary nature. When she awakened, she was in a state of great emotional shock, a condition so filled with peace, joy and extreme exaltation that it resulted in a sort of dementia. An incredible exhilaration. The feeling of this vision never left Dion Fortune. Even in her worst moments it remained with her to guide her. She mentions something similar in her book The Sea Priestess, where she makes Wilfred have a minor experience of this sort while he is sleeping off a heavy Sunday lunch in the fort that he built for his sea priestess. But, it is obviously only a reflection of what she went through earlier. Footnote made in this short end audiobook. This was a typical cosmic glimpse, as among others the Danish sage A. Martinus describes the nature of, in his books, including that about his initiation. End footnote, and goes on to main text. There is no doubt that largely as a result of this dream experience Dion Fortune's future was decided. She would devote the rest of her life to the service of the mysteries through writing, lecturing, serving as a priestess, and also establish a group of her own. It was undoubtedly this experience that caused the Society of the Inner Light to take a completely different form from the structure of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, into which she herself was later to be initiated into, at least into the lower grades. Editor's note, Dion Fortune officially had but this one significant dream which she writes about in the foreword to the Cosmic Doctrine. This is what she wanted the public to know. But in actual fact, she had two dreams separated by about a month in time. The second dream seems to have provided the spur for her future activities. The first dream had not produced enough reaction to get her moving and the second was needed to kick her and tell her to do something. In the second dream it was notable that there were only two adept figures. The green ray figure had been withdrawn and only the adepts of the hermetic and the devotional rays remained for the intense discussion. Dion Fortune's writing reveals that she had a deep inner sympathy with Green Ray Elemental and it is quite possible that had she been left to her own devices, she might well have gone strongly onto the Green Ray contacts and to some extent on the Hermetic, but largely would have ignored the devotional. Removing the Green Ray contact from this dream experience puts stress on the fact that while it was recognized that she would have to develop her hermetic side in order to run an occult group, she was also strongly urged to make the devotional ray a real part of her life because this was something that was considered to be dangerously deficient in her. After the Society of the Inner Light was organized, Dion Fortune had the three distinct divisions operating, Green Ray, Hermetic and Devotional Rays. Although she personally had many Green Ray experiences, and organized some of the Green Ray work, she did not direct its activities, she did most of her work on the devotional and hermetic side. Other people like Colonel Seymour did a tremendous amount of work on the Green Ray, but Dion Fortune did not. This would seem to back up the idea that she had far too great a natural sympathy for it and could have become unbalanced. It is also well to note that in one of the Dr. Taverner stories, a daughter of Pan. The hero is falling in love with this strange, elfin girl and is having a very difficult job in pulling himself back to normality. She spends a good deal of descriptive time talking about how the smell of the drugs in the dispensary and the sight of medical instruments refocused his mind on the intellectual side of things, and helped him to draw back from involvement on the Green Ray, where he would have stopped being a full human being and would have ended up being taken over by the forces of nature. She makes quite a point of this, rather more than is necessary for the literary purposes of the story. One consideration for this Green Ray adaptment is the fact that Dion Fortune was very strongly Nordic through her bloodstock. The theory of route tracers has much to do with the development of different phases of evolution on the surface of the Earth, and it is said that the origins of races came about at the time when certain conditions were being laid down on the Earth. One of these conditions was connected with the establishment of the etheric matrix, or net, which holds together the physical matter of which the Earth is made. It is said that the races have their origins at different times and they develop in cycles, and that some route races are therefore much more strongly connected to the Earth's development than others. The Nordic race was said to have its roots in times of this particular epoch, when the etheric stresses were being laid down and before the Earth became firmly physical. This period, or the forces governing this period, were called the Red Ray and were the immediate forerunner of the Green Ray, or Elemental Ray. Very likely one of the fears on the part of the adepts was that Nordic Dion Fortune, if allowed to regress to the Elemental Ray, would automatically pass through this and back onto the Red Ray. The Red Ray is a very primitive ray, which obviously in terms of time must relate to a period in the ice evolution and to the tooth and claw standard of ethics and morals which applied then. This tendency was made very plain in the psychic self-defense story about the famous wolf, which was materialized while brooding on an injustice that had been done her. This wolf was made out of her own etheric substance in the way that a medium can sometimes materialize the figure of someone departed. It is notable that the opportunity for revenge on the person who had done her wrong came about after the wolf had materialized. That is a typical Red Ray phenomenon, the wolf being in fact etheric and made up of nothing more substantial than a set of stresses. Nevertheless, the wolf would have a very real negative action upon anyone to whom it was directed. This story appears to bear out the fact that Dion Fortune had a tendency to regress, as it is going back to an earlier human condition. Next headline is, Dr. Moriarty. There is an old saying in the occult that when the pupil is ready, the master will appear. About 1917, toward the end of World War I, Dion Fortune came into contact with a man who had a tremendous influence on her future, a man by the name of Moriarty. He was a most remarkable personality and the prototype from which her fictional character of Dr. Tavernier later developed. Moriarty had some connection with the Order of the Golden Dawn, but he was by nature a solitary occultist. His special interest was in astro-etheric conditions and psychology and healing. He thought that disease or mental affliction could only be properly explained by an understanding of the inner nature of man, and possibly by an investigation into past incarnations where the originating cause might be found. He was a doctor of medicine and at one time had served in the medical service in India. Dr. Moriarty's techniques and treatments were unusual, and to get away from his orthodox colleagues he set up a training school in the Hampshire Barrens, the country between London and Southampton. It is a great area of heather, sandy ground, and pine trees, and somewhere in the middle of this was his center. It consisted of a series of cottages in a small hamlet, and those who wanted to be trained could come and stay in one of the cottages and become a member of his community for a period of time. Moriarty had some strange characteristics that would not endear him to modern occult students. His establishment seemed to be run on the lines of the Gurdjieff Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man, which was located near Paris. Next headline is, Dr. Tavernier. Dr. Tavernier was not a healer of bodily ailments, he was a physician of souls. It is said that the similarity between this drawing and the real Dr. Moriarty is uncanny gold. In training his students, Gurdjieff would frequently employ hard physical labor such as chopping trees, constructing buildings, and other things requiring strenuous exercise. The idea was that the student who concentrated upon the physical things he was doing was in effect tying up the lower levels of his psyche, and this in turn allowed enlightenment to flood in at the higher levels, which were no longer preoccupied with mundane concerns. Certainly some of the characteristics of Moriarty's establishment did resemble Sir Jeith's. At Moriarty's, the student interns were made to work at unaccustomed tasks. For instance, anyone who by nature was an outdoor person, who did well in sports, liked healthy exercise, and so on, would be confined to do secretarial and household tasks, while another, who was essentially an intellectual type and whose world was bounded by books, was made to work in the garden and chop down trees. There was a Mrs. Amy Campbell who was at the Moriarty Training Center at the same time as was Dion Fortune. Mrs. Campbell's interest lay in the Theosophical Society, and later in her life she was head of the East London Lodge of the Theosophical Society in South Africa. After both had attained prominence, Mrs. Campbell enjoyed telling of Dion Fortune's enthusiasm in the garden assignment and the fact that Dion Fortune not only wanted to clear the area thoroughly but also tried to chop down as many nearby trees as possible. One of Moriarty's techniques was not very pleasant for those who were on the receiving end. The technique assigned the trainee a great deal of work calculated to achieve perfection in the house or garden duty. When the work was completed, Moriarty would then in some way destroy it. For example, work in the garden to restore order was rewarded by setting the dogs upon it to dig it up. The idea was that when one ceased to react to his work being destroyed, then a certain stage of development, of detachment, had been reached in the soul. Unfortunately, human nature being what it was, people very rapidly ceased to react outwardly, while fuming inwardly. Whether or not this particular type exercise really achieved its ends is not known. Despite some of his ideas, Moriarty was undoubtedly a genuine adept in the occult sense. Many of the accomplishments recorded of Dr. Taverner have been watered down considerably. Some of the cases he worked on while training Dion Fortune were of a nature that could not be easily written about because they involved unnatural vice of a sexual nature, and one could not write about such things at that time. Moriarty was quite interested in the condition of vampirism. This is a strange pathology which flared up after World War I, involving a situation in which one human being feeds upon the energies of another. These energies can be of various levels, but in some of the cases recorded of Dr. Moriarty, they actually involved the drawing of blood in the traditional Transylvanian manner. Quite often these cases of vampirism were allied in some way to other forms of unnatural vice. Dion Fortune mentions that Taverner considered this curious type of psychic contamination to have originated in certain troops from the area known as Transylvania, the traditional home of the vampire. The carnage in World War I needs no commentary. It was not uncommon for a mentally deranged person to be tempted to drink the blood of severely wounded soldiers. Taverner's idea was that this pathological urge originated from a newly dead person who, for reasons of his own, sought at all costs to avoid leaving this physical world and going onto the plane of the dead. The semi-dead soldier achieved his ends by associating himself psychically with a fairly unstable or shell-shocked soldier and then causing that soldier to make the actual physical contact with the source of energy, the blood of the wounded or dying soldier. Dr. Moriarty, through his knowledge and ability in psychiatric medicine, was in many cases able to break this contact and restore the person to normal life. Dion Fortune was associated with Moriarty for various periods of time until the end of the war and beyond, and maintained this close contact up into 1919 when she joined the Order of the Golden Dawn and their paths separated. Probably the most valuable thing that Moriarty did for Dion Fortune was to help her to bring the great mass of memories and knowledge of her past lives into the present and to see a regular plan behind it. This unconscious material had been brought dose in the surface as a result of her psychic shock at the hands of the school directoress. Moriarty had trained Dion Fortune up to the point where she had a very clear understanding and a good outline in her mind of the Western mysteries. Because of her studies, experience as a lay Freudian analyst, her 2 years under the guidance of Moriarty, her recall of previous incarnations, and her recovery of training and competence in these prior lives, Dion Fortune was now ready to go out on her own. Dion Fortune was a very powerful personality while she was still the young woman of 30. She was essentially a practical, doing person. She would never just listen. If something was good, she wanted to put it to practical use. Essentially, she was not of a mystical nature, but her experience in the Theosophical Society Library Dream had placed her under the care of the Master of Love and Compassion. Moriarty died in 1921, and Mrs. Amy Campbell reports that Dion Fortune appeared in a purple robe before a number of Moriarty's students attending one of the memorial gatherings and said, "Our master is dead, follow me." Most of them did not choose to do so, as Dion Fortune was so very young, just 30 at the time. Some half a dozen did follow her, and this little group were some of the earliest members of the Society of the Inner Light. These members were quite a boon to Dion Fortune's early efforts, as these followers were all sincere and well-trained students of the mysteries. Next headline is, Occult Police. Dion Fortune particularly disliked one Indian guru who had come to England in the early 20s to cause unrest and confusion in the British group mind. His plan was to trick unsuspecting women out of their money, abandon them, and then use the money in activities to cause unrest. All of this was done at the unconscious levels of the mind, and there were no laws broken for the local police to act upon. She was so angry that she kept picking at the problem until she remembered that there was a group within the occult world that oversaw all magical activities and took action when black magic practitioners got too far out of line. She decided to appeal to this surveillance group and proceeded to put out a clairvoyant call to them for help. Dion Fortune projected her thought through willpower that was filled with emotion and mentally sent it out with all the force that she could muster. Very shortly she received a message through a clear, inner voice that said to her, "Go to Colonel Y." She did not reveal Colonel Y's name, but he was an eminent official in the government, so prominent in fact that she was afraid to approach him. Really, even more than his importance was the British custom that would not allow her to speak to him without a proper introduction. So she talked back to the inner planes and told them, "That is impossible, as I have not been introduced. Give me a sign." With that, the inner planes said that the sign would be that Colonel Y will be at your next lecture. Again, Dion Fortune argued that it was impossible because Colonel Y's regiment had been ordered abroad and he would not be in England. The inner voice reiterated firmly, "Colonel Y will be at your next lecture." Dion Fortune was due to lecture in a certain town, and when the day of the lecture came around, she went to the town. As she was going up the steps to the lecture hall, she saw Colonel Y was just ahead of her. This more or less cleared up all of her doubts. Immediately after the lecture was finished, she went from there and approached him. "I have a message for you," she said. To which he turned quite naturally and replied, "Yes, I know. I have been told to expect it." She then told him everything she knew and all her fears and misgivings. He replied, "There is rather more to it than that, but do not worry. Leave it in my hands, and thank you." When later she spoke to her inner plane sources and asked if any more action was called for, they replied, "Surprisingly, no action now. Later, not yet." Shortly thereafter she heard that this rather undesirable Indian occultist had left the country within a few days of her contact. There were basically three types of occult abuse according to Dion Fortune. In the first category came the fools, and on these she did not waste her powder and shot. Then there were the charlatans, and finally those she called the grey and black occultists. The charlatans were basically occult con men and tricksters. They were mysterious adepts who had just returned from the continent or from the east, both rather vague addresses, and charged large sums of money to the gullible for so-called initiation into the higher degrees of an occult order of which they claimed to be the head. This was a typical malpractice of the day. In her own words, she thought that if people were stupid enough to pay perhaps £300 for a certain bogus initiation, then they deserved all they got. Apart from writing about them in her articles, she considered them beneath contempt. The group she really disliked were those who, by using debased occult methods, gained advantage over other human beings, often reducing them to a nervous breakdown or insanity and usually taking their life savings in the process. A typical group of this sort would be drawn to and surround a magnetic, charismatic figure. A group would consist very largely of women. Nowadays, it is very doubtful if such an organization could exist because of greater education and the emancipation of women generally, but in those days not only was it distinct possibility, it was all too common. The practice that was generally adopted by these undesirables was to involve the members of the group in some sort of hypnotic rapport with the leader, under the excuse that this furthered the development of an occult group mind and knit together the fabric of the group so it could act more cohesively. This in itself was very unethical. It was followed by many other practices which developed very strong and unhealthy attachment to the group leader by these unsuspecting women. The system operated in such a manner as to keep those people bound to the group through the projected transference onto the group leader. Unfortunately, the women were encouraged to give large sums of money for the support of the organization, would get caught up in the emotion of it all, and would end up quite destitute, as well as psychologically deranged. Certainly, most of them were in bad shape when they left the group because when they ceased to provide psychic energy and money, they were frequently expelled and were left with no financial resources and in a psychotic state. Sometimes this sort of operation was less on a group basis and more specific. In Psychic Self-Defense Link, Dion Fortune gives details of a man who ran a strange sort of group where he and several colleagues were attempting to use hypnotic techniques and other occult practices to attract women to his group, and then excite them into a peculiar emotional state. When the women were sufficiently aroused on this level, the leader would make use of this emotional rapport and use it for his own purposes, generally in building up his own magnetic magical personality. This resulted in the members of the group becoming enraptured by the leader and their energy was magnetically drained and depleted for the leader's own use. In ordinary psychological language, it maintained the members in a state of perpetual projection. Sometimes this went further and the more nubile of the ladies concerned were frequently encouraged to engage in an operation which is called congressus subtilis, or subtle sex. The young woman was developed in such a way as to loosen the bonds between the astro-etheric body and the rest of the psyche. This training resulted in a sort of debased ability to project the astral body. The lady concerned would be told to meditate strongly upon the leader of the group, before going to sleep. By various practices, the bonds between the astro-etheric soul and the rest of the psyche were progressively loosened. If the method succeeded, astral projection would frequently take place and congressus subtilis, or astral sex with the group leader would occur. It may be argued in our present emancipated state, that astral sex is in no way more central than physical sex. But it has to be remembered that this was done in an unethical manner and that the young woman concerned frequently had no idea that her occult practices would lead to astral sex. It was also done in a manner that resulted in a sort of debased love affair between the woman concerned and the leader of the group. She was projecting onto him her emotional energy which was being progressively drained away. This process was a type of etheric vampirism. Practices of this nature were reportedly very common during the 1920s, and we should ask ourselves if they could happen now. The answer is probably no. Because most young women, and certainly young men, are much better informed, not only about the physical details of the sex life but also have more experience from quite a young age of relationship and the emotional side of sex. To most young people nowadays there would be little advantage in going through a series of complex mental procedures to achieve what could be done physically in full consciousness. Another category of abuse concerned simple homosexuality. Some groups were considered gray or black, because of their magical use of sodomy or unnatural sex in one form or another. The technical details of this sort of operation are fairly complex, but basically it must be remembered that in normal sex a flow of force passes between the male and female participants and is grounded by polarity in a natural way. In unnatural sex or magical abuse, the flow of force is short-circuited by the deviated act and instead of passing cleanly through the system and being grounded, as in natural coitus, sex, it is made available for debased use by the occult practitioner. It does not go to ground, it does not pass into circuit with the forces of the universe, it is held up, short-circuited, and thus made available for gray, black purposes. Dion Fortune often stressed how infrequently really high-powered black magic was encountered.